is 16-1313, Sandoval versus United States. Whenever you're ready, sir.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Plaintiffs argue that... Plaintiffs argue that there was no contract. There was no acceptance of the waivers. And because there were the waivers were not accepted or performed, then the assessments themselves were invalid.
I thought your position was that they withdrew their consent.
Correct. There's actually several arguments. One is that the waivers are invalid because, excuse me, Your Honor, the waivers were invalid because there was no acceptance. When you look at the letters 987, one indicates that we reviewed and we made no changes to the report. And then we look at the second, the revised form letter 987. That clearly indicates that the waivers were accepted. But in this case, the second 987, which is the June 2007, that
You're
was
gonna
never
You're going to have to give us can you give us an appendix site?
Yes, Your Honor. I would have to look through the file and provide the two letters.
Okay, well, give us a date then, at least.
Yes, the letter of the 987, one is November 5th, 2007. The second one is November 7th, 2007. And that's the original letter that was sent to the taxpayers by PSP. PSP is the IRS processing unit. Now, the revised 987 letter, that was never issued to the plaintiffs. And it was through discovery that plaintiffs discovered that there was no acceptance. Now, the second component in terms of there was no waivers is the waivers were withdrawn. The plaintiffs were informed that the agreements were accepted. Actually, that there was an agreement, the taxes were assessed, and the cases were closed from the group. And that is based on the fact of audit reconsideration. Audit reconsideration as set forth...
I'm sorry. Can you just step back a minute? I'm trying to understand what the evidence that you presented was to support a finding that they withdrew their consent. So can you point to anything in the record on that point?
Yes. If we look at... Exhibit 41P, which is Appendix 12, which sets out a letter which is dated November 2nd, 2007. Now, that letter indicates that Mr. Gann, who was the revenue agent that audited the tax...
You're talking about A12 in the appendix?
Yes, A12.
Okay.
Which indicates that Mr. Gann informed the taxpayers that the cases were closed from the group. Now, with that letter, you have to go through several exhibits. If you go through to appendix, and it's Defendant's Exhibit 9D, and that is a defendant's contact and activity sheets. And that sheet confirms that Mr. Gann is informing the plaintiffs that these cases were closed, that the taxes were assessed, and that requesting or directing the plaintiffs to proceed with audit reconsideration. Now, that evidence, when you look at the exhibit A12, it would also go, it refers you to the transmittal report. And the transmittal report is Appendix A1. And on that transmittal report, Mr. Gann is telling all the parties that, one, there was an agreement, two, that after the taxpayers received representation, that these, after the additional taxes were assessed, the plaintiffs received representation and the cases are closed. All those facts, as you defined, as stated out in the complaint, they set out what audit reconsideration meant. It means that there was a prior audit, there was an agreement, there was an assessment, and the case is closed. But if you look at the factual record from the letter that was issued to the defendant, which ties in to the contacts and activities report, which also ties in to the report transmittal, which is Appendix A1, and then we look at
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a couple of housekeeping questions.
Yes.
I'm having real trouble with your reference. You say on page 8 of your brief, claims hereby incorporate by reference the following relevant documents. And then you list complaint, answer, and so on. Yes. What's your procedural basis for incorporating those by reference into an appellate brief?
Well, in my reference is that they're part of, based on the, civil rules of procedure, they're part of the case.
Based on what? Were you going to say FRAP, Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure?
Right. In essence,
and
that...
And what rule is that?
I would have to look at the rule itself, Your Honor. But it's my understanding...
You do that, and you let me know.
Okay.
Okay, now let's turn to page 16, where you say, in another litany, Plaintiff White's wife stated, quote, when my attorney spoke with Mr. Gann on the phone, Mr. Gann indicated that the cases were closed, and they were also closed by the group manager, Ms. Michelle Palace. And my note in here is, how exactly is this not hearsay?
Your Honor, it's not hearsay in a sense that it is a state of mind issue. In a state of mind, it is not.
Oh, so it's not asserted for the truth of the matter contained therein?
It's set out to show what they believed at that time. So it is not non-hearsay. And when you look at these facts, Your Honor, and I think
so we're not you don't expect us to believe that the attorney actually said that.
Your Honor, these are agency statements, and the attorney and the client, they would be part of that person. So it would be a non-hearsay matter as well. The attorney is the agent of that taxpayer. But I think what has to be reviewed is that when you look at the facts and circumstances of the case from the A12, the contacts and activities report, A122, we also look at A1, and we see a consistent pattern in which the information...
Am I missing an appendix? I have a supplemental appendix, and I have your brief with appendix documents attached there, too. Is there something else that we didn't get?
It's possible, Your Honor. I would have to look.
Don't. Come on, counsel. You're supposed to know your record to that extent. Did you submit an appendix other than what was attached?
I did not submit a full appendix, but counsel did submit an appendix.
So to what are you referencing when you say A12?
A12, it would be a defendant's appendix, which is A124.
Okay, I'm at the end of your brief, where you sign your name on page 46. And then I have page 48, which is your declaration. And the next page is A156. So where's 12?
Your Honor, it's in defendant's appendix.
In the red, in the red appendix?
It should be in the red appendix.
And what is, so I've got SA 124. What are you referring to? This is a worksheet for child tax credits.
No, it, there should be in the appendix an exhibit 1P, excuse me, exhibit 124. It's part, should be part of that exhibit, Your Honor.
Well, you're going to have, I mean, we've gone through the appendix, but if you want us to rely on something and think about something, you have to give us a citation so we can refer to it. I don't...
Your Honor, these exhibits are part of defendant's summary motion exhibits, and I'm referring to, and I believe the rules allow reference to those appendix.
Sure they do. So you're referring to the supplemental appendix, SA, rather than A. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, I am referring to the... I believe defendant filed a supplement.
Counsel, you have to understand. If you say A12, I go looking in your appendix. If you say SA12, I'll go look in theirs. But you have to help us.
Okay. Your Honor, I believe the best is to look at the summary judgment motion, and they
what
would be
age?
In, it would be 124.
Of what?
It would be of defendant's motion for summary judgment.
No, but where is it in the appendix? Where can we find it?
It's not in my appendix, Your Honor.
Is it in the appendix?
And it's not in the government's appendix.
It should be in defendant's.
SA 124 is a document entitled Taxable Earned Income Worksheet for Child Tax Credit. You're not helping us.
Yeah. I do apologize, Your Honor.
Have you gone through the supplemental appendix so that you're aware
I
what's
have, Your
here
Honor.
And what's not?
I have, but it was my understanding that I could refer under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure based on the court rules, I can refer to the documents from the trial. And
well, you can if they're contained in the appendix that you've submitted.
You're telling us they're not?
They're not part of the appendix that I submitted to the court, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, that's a problem, and I don't know what rule you're referring to, but if your brief is citing and relying on, for purposes of argument, portions of the record, those portions of the record should be included in the appendix.
I do apologize, Your Honor.
Well, why don't we hear from the government, and we'll retain the rest of your rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I'm Regina Moriarty on behalf of the United States.
Okay. Can you just help us out at the beginning? I know it's not your job, but we really are obviously confused up here in terms of the record. So do you know whether we're missing something? The documents that your friend referred to, are they anywhere in the appendix?
Some of them will be in my supplemental appendix. A lot of them are not. The court rules, of course, as you know, the appellants, to contact the appellee to jointly deal with the appendix. That never happened in this case. Your rules also allowed the government to submit their own supplemental appendix. So in this case, in my supplemental appendix, I put in everything that we thought was relevant to the government's argument.
And that you cite in your appeal.
And that I cite in my appendix. The one exception, I think, is maybe a claim for refund that was sealed in this case. And I wasn't really sure how to deal with I didn't want to put a sealed document in, and I believe it was sealed because the Social Security numbers weren't redacted. And it really wasn't that important to our case, so I left that out. I think that all of his cites are probably, or most of them are to federal court of claims documents that were filed in the original record, a lot of them.
Well, do you have a view? I mean, you may know the you obviously know the record better than we do, so do you have a view on responding to the assertions he's made with respect to those documents? Are you able to do that?
My first response is going to be that the courts have held that the Form 4549 is not a contract. It's a unilateral waiver. It's an abandonment of a defense. It doesn't, in this case, it is in fact signed by the revenue agent. And in his testimony in his deposition when he explained that where it says, is this form subject to review by the district director? It's because they're looking for errors that he might have made. And it's not like it's a contract that the taxpayer can come back and say, well, we both signed this document and that's the number we agreed to. So there's still some review. But all of the terms of a case being closed and audit reconsideration, those are all terms that are identified in the Internal Revenue Manual as guidance for the IRS employees when they're doing an audit. The statutes in this case never discuss those. And so when you look at 6213, and it talks about before a tax can be assessed, you have to have a notice of deficiency, but a taxpayer can waive that in writing. And then you turn to the regulations, and it says that waiver can be withdrawn before assessment. So those are what the government's position is. Those are the critical things to look for, not whether a case has been closed, not whether a case is in audit reconsideration. The revenue agent explained here that he audited these taxpayers for over a year, and he closed the case because it was his impression that there was nothing else more to be gained. He had dealt with them. He thought he had provided them all the information that they had. When my opposing counsel got involved and sent the letter, he indicated in that letter that he was working with the taxpayers, and in a couple of weeks he thought he would have more records available. And at that point, I think the IRS very nicely went ahead and said, okay, let's reconsider this information. They worked with these taxpayers for quite a long time, and they, in fact,
Substantially reduced it.
Yeah. And the bottom line here is that they filed these amended returns, and they may be a little quirky in some of the columns, but column C of those amended returns, which are signed under penalties of perjury, which say everything in here is true to our belief, that lists a tax. And with that return, that amended return, they submit checks. So if you fill out your tax return on April 15th and you send it in with a check, the IRS considers that a payment. That amount never has to be assessed. They usually routinely are, but if it's not, that's a payment of tax. So when you submit a check, a remittance, unless you identify it specifically as a deposit, which is what the new code section 6603 deals with, it's going to be considered a payment. So in this case, the remittances were sent in.
And what is the consequence? What is the difference? Why are we arguing about payments and deposits?
If it's a payment of tax, you can file a claim for refund within 2 years to get that back. If it's a deposit, there's no clock running for that. As is relevant in this case, if it's a payment of tax, the case law has said even if there's no assessment in this case, you cannot get that money back if it was a payment of tax unless you show that you have, in fact, overpaid your taxes. In this case, they've never claimed in their claim for refunds, even in their briefs here, they've never claimed we've paid more than we're due. All of their arguments have been there was no valid assessment because I withdrew this waiver, which we don't believe they did, but even if it was withdrawn, as our brief explains, they haven't overpaid their taxes because what was assessed was the amounts that they listed on their amended return that their counsel said in the letter providing this to the IRS that we believe that these are substantially correct amounts. When you look at the deposition testimony of the wife in this case, she reiterated that. We submitted these amounts because we believe that was the amount of tax that we owed. Does the court have any questions?
Thank you.
Your Honor, in regards to my colleague's information, the 4549s are, in fact...
Can you speak up again?
Regarding my colleague's representation, a 4549 is a contract. And if you look at the holdings in... the holdings in Stern, in Philadelphia Reading, in Yellow Cab, all of them indicate, in essence, that these, whether it's an 870 or 4549, they are contracts. And because they are contracts, the terms of acceptance must be fully complied with. In this case, there was no acceptance. The form letter 987, which sets out, we have reviewed and accepted, the taxpayers never received. And because of that, based on Philadelphia and Reading Corp, which is significantly similar to our case, where the cases were in processing, the waivers were never accepted, the assessments were never made, and in essence, because there was no acceptance of those waivers, the waivers were invalid, and in theory, legal theory, they were entitled to a 90-day letter, and they never received a 90-day letter. And now going into the issue that you have indicated in terms of a payment versus a deposit. In terms of a payment versus a deposit, if it's a deposit, then the taxpayers are entitled to all the money, whether it's tax or interest. The courts have held in New York Life, in Rosamond, in various other cases, that a deposit, you cannot go to the merits of the assessment. You cannot, there's
where
no
Where did
equity.
They indicate on the payment that it was a deposit, not payment?
Your Honor, if you review even the Revenue Procedure 2005-18, a deposit is not required. A statement of deposit isn't required on that form. It also classifies a payment where it doesn't state that it's a deposit as a deposit if the taxpayers did not remit full payment. By the fact that the taxpayers, when you look at these amended returns, they do not remit, they do not agree nor remit 100% of the tax. And the other part that has to be considered is that when my colleague makes reference to the amended returns that are dated June 25th.
So you're saying they paid less than they owe.
They paid less than they owe.
And therefore, by definition, it's a deposit and not a payment?
In that argument, it becomes a deposit. Just by reading...
So you're conceding they owe more taxes?
No, they don't owe any more taxes because there were some offsets. What the government did is in 2003, in 2007, there were refunds. So the government took, under Section 6402, they took amounts of refunds from a prior year and offset them against the liabilities that were set out in 2003 and 2004. And by that, in essence, they levied their account to service a disputed liability. But as my counsel had argued, that if it applies new law, and if you apply 2005-18, that revenue procedure, if you follow those rules, it still comes out that it is a deposit. Because there was no full agreement, and these amended returns, they have to be taken in its true context, because they're not amended returns.
Okay. Your time has expired. We thank both counsel. The case is